discussion. I'm sure, given what we've heard, at this discussion period, probably is not going to need very much input from me. But what I thought I would do was at least a couple of talking points that at least I would think merit further discussion. And this is not meant to be exclusive of any other ideas or questions, of course, but just as a starting point. So since Mark went first, perhaps we could reanalyze the question of what the implications are for the improved position and proper motion measurement of Sagittarius A star. Martin.
So Mark mentioned that in the next 10 years, they should be able to nail down the mass of the black hole. And it seems to me that at most, what you can, the mass estimate that you can get is the mass of the black hole plus the mass of the, you know, the central cap from the distributed component that you expect. I mean, if I interpret correctly the paper by Satoshi and Kerfin, the reason that they are able to assume a planar model is because they claim that you get rid of the cap by putting that mass to the black hole, right? We know that the planar model does not produce the cap. So they say you can define an effective mass for the black hole and put in the mass that should be the real cap into the black hole. So at most, if you're going to use combine the observational results with the results with that paper, they're going to get the mass of the black hole plus the mass of the central cap.
I don't think that's right. We'll have to read the paper carefully, but it's asking the direct question. If you've got a total mass, that's given. And then you say, if you have a black hole of a certain mass, what should be its motion in one dimension, whichever dimension it is. That's the only question directly to be answered. The total of the whole thing has to add up.
I'm pretty sure that they, at first I remember, was the reason they were able to use a planar model, which they say that it might be not the most correct thing to use in that case, because of the presence of the black hole.
I don't know the difference if they use a different stellar model. That's a good question, as to how it would affect the grounding motion. By the way, just as a point, now that I've seen Andrea's point, the mass estimate I gave should be raised by a factor of 3, because she has a star that's in closer by a factor of 3 than before. And so it's going up as we speak.
Andrea. Yeah, so the first point, I think there are some papers out that show that the binary black holes in clusters have a much stronger interaction with the sea of stars. So they also show much higher Brownian motion. So I assume, I didn't really look into this, that I can basically rule out a binary dark mass at the center.
Well, I would think if they were, you know, comparable masses, yes. If you make a binary with 100 solar mass and a million solar mass, it's not going to make any difference. So
yeah, of course.
If there's some crossover, where it would be hard to say, and we could try to analyze that crossover.
Actually, at a meeting, I met Milos, I forgot his name.
Milos Savovic.
Yeah. Well, after that meeting, we made a, based on your old measurements, not the new measurements, what's the allowed parameter space for binary black holes? So there is a little wedge that exists.
Oh, in that old paper, yeah. Certainly, there's one thing we cannot do with the VLBI observation. And that is that if you had a binary black hole within our angular resolution, of a milli, 7/10 of a milliarc second. They could be orbiting each other at a fantastic speed and we wouldn't know it.
Yeah, right.
So within 0.7 milliarc seconds, we can't say there isn't a binary. They're that tight.
How long would that live?
Oh, it will in spiral. That one's ruled out based on just lifetime.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll spend some time actually talking about these limits tomorrow, where basically the brightness is consistent with the 2% secondary black hole. It doesn't mean it exists.
Keeps us interested.
Just make sure people don't get too drunk tonight.
You won't either, right?
That's a job for
you. Okay, well, one of the things that intrigued me specifically was S16. and how close it got to the black hole. And I carried out a very simple back of the envelope estimate last night, or the night before, and this is almost guaranteed that I've made a mistake, but if these estimates are correct, what I determined was that the change in internal energy for the star for every sweep around the black hole due to the tidal work being done on it would be about 10 to the minus 6 of its binding energy. And Tell probably has a better feel for this. But if that number is right for S16, it means that every million orbits, its internal energy would double. So that means that, you know, given its lifetime of 10 million years, we might expect to see substantial heating, internal heating.
That does match. I didn't do that calculation specifically for S16, but for S2, which is only, I think, 2 times further away, it's completely negligible. And the since the tidal interaction roughly falls off as a periapsis distance to the sixth power, if you go a factor 2 inwards, then you just gain, what, a factor of 64. I don't think that brings you even to 10 to the minus 6. But I'm willing to check it again.
I think the point Fobio's thinking is if you get rid of many orbits, it becomes a sizable.
So the tiling spiral time for S2 was like 10 to power n Hubble times, where n was so is a large number of the order of between 10 and 40. And the reason that I cannot estimate it is because my tables for the tidal and the coupling coefficient don't go to such large radii. Okay.
Tal, I thought a big point of your talk was that they'll never go that long, that they'll be perturbed by other stars. And
yeah, just to say, even under the most ideal conditions, where they're just there in a stable orbit and nothing perturbs them.
So in the case of S2, for example, how long is it likely to stay in that orbit?
Oh, it will die out of old age. It's much more danger of being knocked out by another star than by interacting strongly with the black hole.
Any possible, you know, this S starts interchanging the angular momentum with some inside of the upper inflow.
I need to write the question to Tal because we actually talked about this a year ago.
I didn't quite hear the question.
The question was, is it possible that S2 may exchange angular momentum, orbital angular momentum, some of the inflow gas?
Yeah. Because it's inflow gas pouring in, some of the angular moment transfers its orbiting star.
So if indeed this is a hot inflow, the accretion mode is a hot, some kind of the hot inflow type, then it's too tenuous to probably, I didn't do the numbers, but it's probably too tenuous to actually affect in any significant way the orbital parameters of it.
I think what's much more likely is that S2 is going to be affected by the other stars. I mean, at its furthest distance, the velocity is comparable to the escape velocity from the star, so it's likely to undergo collisions.
I would like to mention also, again, that the fit to the cusp that results in a size of half an arc second or so coincides quite nicely, or interestingly, with the size of the extended X-ray emission. That was one of the questions that was raised earlier, so that may tell us something.
What about the origin of S2 and the other S stars?
There's a big silent question mark. I'm looking.
That's in my old scenario, there was no problem. Unfortunately, it's not valid anymore.
Well, Farhad is not here, so in his stead, I'm going to pose a question that he actually asked about 4 years ago in the previous meeting, which was, what does everyone think of the possibility that the 50 kilometer per second Lyra cloud actually has star formation taking place within it, and that as the cloud passes through the galactic center, the deepening potential well captures the more massive stars because of gravitational friction, which goes as the mass of the star. So presumably the more massive ones would be trapped, whereas the other ones would continue to pass on through.
So what we see, so when I talk about the 50 kilometers per second cloud, I talk about the GMC, so 10 to the 5 solar mass, which is at the east. So I think we place it with two mass absorption quite near the galactic center. So, and we don't see any line of sight gradient, and there's no real radial velocity gradient. And I don't see how dynamically, so conservation of angular momentum and whatever, it's impossible that this cloud is flowing onto the galactic center. I don't see how you do that.
No, no, actually, so we see the OH absorption, you have quite a large gradients.
Yes, but I talk about the 10 to the 5 solar mass. We don't talk about the same things. You're talking about things which are going beyond this, but I talk about this 10 to the 5 really massive GNSS. For me, that's impossible. So just from dynamical reasons, not from kinematics, dynamics, so conservation of angular momentum. That's what I have in mind is more than that there's a subcloud which is torn of such a big GMC and which is then wandering onto, I will talk about that tomorrow, on a pre-existing, for example, CND, and then it depends if it's a prograde or retrograde encounter, what happens. But in principle, if you have a pre-existing disk already inside, you drop on a cloud, let's say of several 10 to the 4 solar masses on that, and a retrograde orbit, you have really something which makes a lot of noise. Which is crashing into the CND, which might have a high collision rate and might form stars. So this, could, for me, is a viable scenario to form a lot of stars. And if you believe in collective relaxation, this means of a mass of stars within a background of a lot of small stars, then it might be possible that if you build these stars in the CND, so at, let's say at 2 to 5 parsecs, so they have the time just to wander in, but only the massive stars to wander in, and this gives the right time scale, so 5 to 5 million, 10 million years, that we should still see streaming motions, but they are just losing the information about their initial angular momentum. So this could be a viable orbit. I will talk about that.
In a similar direction, when I look at TJ West, I mean, you see these stars which are embedded in the mid-infrared. There's of course dust in TJ West. You see IRS 13, which is moving with ZJOS, so my very naive picture is there's a train coming in, a dust train, which sort of has formed stars in there, just coming collectively in there, and they're going to stay there. So is that crazy, that you're forming stars within that cloud, and sort of they're collectively coming in, not knowing how it came in there, and who dropped it there, but there is just sort of a stream of stars and dust going in there. So is that right or wrong?
Yeah, the point is the gravitational friction is a strong function of the mass. So when the cloud or the stream comes by the center, presumably the more massive ones are more likely to be trapped than the lighter ones. So,
from this 3D orbit that we got now, the data, so we see that there is a plane for solving the direction. If I make a comparison to the solar system, the comet, so it seems that we need something the equivalent of a hot cloud coming from a location, because it would be essentially in a plane. But you see any direction for the plane, so that's me supposed to be something equivalent of a hot cloud for the A star.
Done. So, I just want to say the Wolf-Rayet stars were initially much more massive than the late type of other stars that we found in the Pacific Horn. So, is that a problem? What you're saying, I think we can figure it out. Is there much more massive?
For the molecular cloud picture?
The dynamic friction.
No, it actually would make it even better.
So, it's better that the Wolf-Rayet stars aren't in the central arc sector?
No, that they are. You're saying that they are, or they are?
They are not.
They are.
It's the lower mass stars that are in the central arc sector, not the lighter stars.
Yeah.
Mark?
Wanted to pick up on this idea of formation in situ as something we shouldn't rule out automatically, even though it seems crazy. If mass does fall onto the galactic center, say by the passage of the 50 kilometer per second object cloud, or by falling in and forming a dispersion ring like Bob Sanders imagined, but very close to the black hole, we're almost guaranteed a tremendous accretion and very sudden accretion event accompanying that event, such that a tremendous amount of energy will come explosively out of Sagittarius A star in that accretion event. So the question becomes, if we can imagine an almost supernova-like blast wave coming out from that accretion event, how close in could stars form from such an overwhelming compression?
Is that really true? Now, if we increase the accretion rate on Sagittarius star by 3 orders of magnitude, that's going to be a 10^38 ergs per second source in the center. Well, that's like any other X-ray binary. The rest
about
of the galaxy.
Pushing the Eddington limit in one fell swoop by throwing in a high density molecular cloud.
Or tidal disruption.
Tidal disruption of a star.
Yeah.
I just want to be careful or cautious that, as we see, always accretion leads to, or matter being in the surrounding leads to some gigantic outburst, as we see in most other nearby galaxies. It's a rather rare event. I mean, there's some limits on sort of X-ray flares in Seyfert galaxies, which seem to be rather rare. Occasionally, you see a spike in the X-rays, but they're not enormous either. So, it's a question of how often really that happens, especially at the current redshift, so to speak, we're living.
I think the duty cycle for that can be imagined to be something like 10 million years, and it must happen very quickly. The circumnuclear disk itself is being kept at bay, perhaps by the winds from the helium emission line stars now. But when those stars die out, the natural evolution of that disk is to migrate inward. That could be the source.
But not as clouds. The problem is that you have clouds which are dense enough not to be sheared will collapse. Those which are not dense enough, they will be sheared. So you have a problem keeping these clouds together at really small distances. And this, it makes it worse if you have a UV radiation field. It makes it better because it takes off the outer envelope and you can have higher densities and smaller masses. So you can even get closer. But if you shut off this UV radiation field, then these clouds should become bigger and this limit for a cloud which can stay really a cloud is pushed outwards even, so it makes it worse. So it's really a problem to keep really self-gravitating clouds up to a radius within 2 parsecs, smaller than 2 parsecs. That's not that.
I would recommend that you look at the paper on the post there, where we do show this streamer going in, from projected the distance of CND in right towards Sagittarius A star, and its velocity drops. It just collects around Sagittarius A star, and eventually, after the velocity has dropped enough, it coincides exactly with Sagittarius A star. So there's some kind of gas which seems to be connecting the outer regions right into A star, judging from the OH absorption results. So take a look at that streamer.
How do you explain the
difference
of the plane of orbit?
Well, it's not in the plane of the orbit of the CND, that's for sure. And the velocity is completely different also. So it comes from somewhere else. It could be perhaps coming from the plus 20 kilometers per second cloud.
I was thinking, with the work Tal's done, he's basically showing that within a short period of time, these stars are going to be, he has them glancing off each other. Mark, didn't you do some work where you said that basically you could have collisional, basically you have these stars colliding, and rather than having a star that has to form, it's just you can set collisions, and they're basically replenished, and that's why you're getting these massive stars, but it's some sort of collision. I thought you did some work.
Yes, I did, but then when we saw the same kinds of stars in the arch.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It didn't look so good anymore.
Oh, I still think for as many O stars as there are in the central parsec, and as fast as they're moving around, it seems like you could have some sort of collisional frequency, and from that go to star-stellar population.
Well, given the fact that loose stragglers are seeming globular clusters, if those are the collision we produced, there have to be the galactic center equivalent.
If they're hitting each other as frequently as Tal seems to indicate, then there's got to be some sort of physical.
We have to be careful about this. These are very high velocity collisions. So the question is, do you actually enhance the merger rate by colliding very violently, or is it better to collide very gently? And I would imagine that for the purpose of a merger, we actually want to bring the stars together at the slowest possible velocity.
But couldn't you look quite good at the maximum?
Well, perhaps. But it's not clear. I don't think that people who do detailed simulations of such collisions have actually figured out what the optimal way of producing merger products would be.
Miller, you were going to say something.
No. I said it now. So right now, so how many orbits are there? No, because speaking this idea of going to the comets. So we know, so the comets are coming from very far, from their orbits, and so we know which is the position of the derivative, I think. And so with those orbits, the few we have seen, so they are very, very close, they've been spiraling and now getting closer, but if we could find some which would be coming from very far.
Well, if you let me assume that there is indeed a black hole, and you let me assume that I can put it at the common location for the three stars where you get to do the full orbit of solution, and there are eight stars for which you can play this game. And the range of Apple-Gothrin distances are about 2,000 to 4,000 AU. So we aren't seeing a huge range, but there you have to be careful because there is some selection effect to seeing being able to stall for orbits that don't have large semi-major axes but do have high eccentricities.
I have a question about the galactic center distance scale. So both of the proper motion groups gave distances, but with pretty large error bars. When we meet in